This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Network. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Network does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
To Advancing the Science of Addiction, I'm your host, Jimmy Alexander, and in today's episode, we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Amy Newman, PhD, who serves as a scientific director at NIDA IRP. Thank you for joining us, Doc. What is NIDA IRP, and what is a scientific director?
Well, thank you, Jimmy. Thank you first for inviting me to come on. And so, in general, the intramural research program of the NIH is where we are actually a research institute. We are doing research as opposed to granting money to outside organizations to do that research. So the rest of the NIH and the rest of NIDA, the other divisions, are actually providing funding through grants and contracts to do research. In the intramural program, we're actually doing the research. We're actually scientists doing research directed toward the mission of NIDA, which of course is to advance science on drug use and addiction and to apply that knowledge to improve individual and public health. As a scientific director, I am the leader of that institute, but as I always say, I'm not the only brain in the room. I've got 25 outstanding principal investigators, we call them, who are either tenured or tenure-track scientists. They lead their own research programs. But what my job really is to support that, to make sure that they have the resources to do the most outstanding work that they can do, to make sure that they know what each other are doing, but what is happening on the outside so that we can be as efficient and productive as possible. And I think the one other distinction I'd like to make is that in the intramural research program, because we're not applying for grants, we are expected to do higher risk, longer term research than perhaps a researcher in an academic institution. So my job is really to be the support behind the science and to really constantly be aware of where we should be doing that work.
What is your day-to-day like with a job like yours, working at a place like you do?
Yeah, my day-to-day is a lot of meetings, to be honest. and that may sound just like horrific, but what's really exciting about it is that every meeting is different. So I may be jumping from a budget meeting to a one-on-one with my postdoctoral fellow to talk about what they're doing in the laboratory, to talking to a collaborator that I have at the University of Copenhagen to talk about the project that we're working on, to, you know, meeting with just in general people in the hallway now that people are back in the hallways and chatting about whatever it is that they're working on, or, you know, the challenges that they have. Again, as a scientific director, one of the jobs that I have is to identify those challenges, which, you know, there are many, and how can we go about improving the situation so that we can do the best work that we can do.
Now, I know your parents had to be so proud of you when you went to school to choose this path, which leads me to ask you, what led you to this path of a career?
You know, I wish I could say that when I was 5 years old, I wanted to be the scientific director of NIDA, but that would be a lie. You know, I gravitated toward math and science. And to be honest, when I went to college, I wanted to be a physician because I knew what a physician was. I had a pediatrician. I did not have any idea what a research scientist was. But as I went through my college education, I became a chemistry major because I really thought it was cool. And I'm kind of a better problem solver than I am a memorizer. And as I kind of went through my 4 years of college, I got more and more interested in kind of combining that medical research area with chemistry. And I ultimately chose to do a PhD in what's called medicinal chemistry, which is really the design or the application of chemistry toward the development of drugs. And that's what I do at NIDA, because in addition to being scientific director, I run the medicinal chemistry laboratory at NIDA and have since 1991. So it's the thing that I'm most passionate about. I never get tired of designing new molecules. I've always been very excited by the creativity that that allows me to kind of project into the world. And with the all always have the hope of developing therapeutics that can help people who have addictions.
Well, it just shows you how intelligent you are, because I'm always excited that I can make lasagna without looking at the directions. And there you are making molecules. That is just amazing. Now, when you tell people what you do for a living, what are a couple questions that they always ask?
I always start out with, I'm a scientist. And then if they're interested, they say, and then I immediately go into the fact that I'm at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and that the science that I do and I lead is directed toward addiction and directed toward understanding what happens in the brain that causes some people to become addicted to drugs. And how can we use that knowledge to develop medications, or even importantly, prevention, so that people who take, for example, a prescription opioid like OxyContin for legitimate reasons don't become addicted to that drug. And so then we start talking about the brain, which is, you know, and always the most interesting thing to most people, that people, oh, how does that work? And for me, it's, yeah, how does that work? And how can I use those small molecules, those drug molecules, to reverse it, to get people to be able to live healthy lives without the substance that they are addicted to?
Well, please forgive me for saying this, because most people don't enjoy compliments. But I've mentioned here before, my family was touched by drug abuse. And we lost my brother to an overdose several years ago. And to know that there are people like you working at the National Institute of Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, that you guys are all there trying to make sure that that doesn't happen to other families, I want to say thank you for that.
Thank you. I wish that we were quicker at it, but you know, we are working at all levels to try to really cover not only opioids, which of course we're still in the midst of an opioid crisis, but you know, there are many substances that people are taking that become addicted, the polysubstance abuse, the fact that we have comorbidities with other neuropsychiatric disorders. People don't always recognize that the people who have bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, they have a very high percentage of substance use disorders. And so that population is kind of left out of the equation, because it's really hard to treat both. And that's something that several of us are really focused on now.
Well, Dr. Newman, that is my brother. My brother had schizophrenia. And, you know, he was on a medication that I believe he would describe, there was no highs, there's no lows. Yeah. You felt nothing. And I think that's what led him to use extracurricular drugs that
very likely. I mean, that I've heard from psychiatrists that, you know, antipsychotics, because they cut out the highs and the lows. It's better than having full blown schizophrenia, but it's not great. And I think there's a very, very high number of people who do exactly what your brother does, which I'm very sorry to hear.
Well, thank you. And just, you know, I try to share his story to show that we're not ashamed of, you know, what happened to Mark. And we just want to share that story, so if it happens to other people, they'll understand and get help. Now, what advice would you give somebody who is interested in a career in science and research?
Yeah, no, one of my favorite things, and actually those meetings I talked to you, we have a summer program at NIDA, which is terrific. Oh, the whole NIH has one, but of course we think NIDA's is one of the best. And I meet with summer students who are at that early stage, and it's so much fun, because they're young and they're excited and they need some guidance. But what I would say is that most important thing is to read and to see what you're interested in. If you have an interest in science or math, even at the early stage of high school, and certainly in college, look for those opportunities reach out to people. People reach out to me by email, and I make time to talk to them about, things that they might be able to do. PhD programs and medical school are pretty competitive to get into. So if you can start early on, and something that I did not do, did not have the opportunity to do, and it was a tough and steep slope to get that PhD, but getting an opportunity to do research as an undergraduate or even in high school, looking into, for example, the NIH summer internship program where our summer students come and they have a fantastic opportunity where they work in the laboratories, they have weekly lectures, are able to present their research. All those things really can galvanize someone's interest. The other thing I would say for this generation of young scientists and junior scientists that we're in a very computational world, and getting that experience, learning how to code, having some idea about the computational tools with AI and machine learning and all that is going to be the future of all science. And so at least being familiar is something that I think is going to be really important for the future. And then dive in, do what you think is exciting, and hopefully find good mentors or a good mentor that can help you move to the next step.
Okay, more coming up with Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Advancing the Science of Addiction is back. I'm Jimmy Alexander, here along with Dr. Amy Newman, PhD. You serve as the scientific director at NIDA, IRP. And it's interesting, as we've been talking about this battle to cure addiction and bring some sort of solace to so many folks who are battling addiction. And I think that comes up with trust, because a lot of times we talk about the worst thing you can say to somebody who has an addiction of any type, is the shame of it, and belittling them and acting like it's as easy as as telling someone to stop biting their fingernails. It's a little more complicated than that. But wouldn't you say it starts with a relationship of trust between what you do and the community?
Yeah, Jimmy, that's such a tough question, to be honest. It's something that is multi-pronged, I think, and I don't think we've got it right yet. I think that the stigma associated with addiction is still prevalent, and it's prevalent at the community level. It's prevalent at the level of pharma. I mean, we have a hard time getting pharmaceutical industry interested in developing medications to treat substance use disorders because there's a stigma associated with that. So I think that there's many levels that we have to continue to work toward. But I think at the community level, we have to do better at getting out there and not projecting a fear of science or of stigma, but rather we are here to help and to listen, to hear what it is that we can do in the short term, and then help those people understand what we're working toward in the long term. Because the reality is, as I said, I'm a medicinal chemist. We've been developing small molecules as tools for 30 years. I don't have a medication that I can show you, although I got one that's close, and I'm really hoping that it's going to get into the clinical trials by the end of this year. But it's a long-term process to develop new medications and to make sure that they're safe and they're effective. And I think the other thing that's disappointing, but it's the reality, is that there's no single silver bullet. We don't have one drug that cures cancer. We are not going to have one drug that cures addiction. But my mantra has always been, if we can help some people, and that's better than what we're doing now for most people, is really trying to convey that we're working at many different angles. I think that we have a long way to go to develop that toolbox. We have medications for opioid use disorder, but it's an imperfect toolbox and it's not a big toolbox. And I think expanding that, but also expanding that toward cocaine, methamphetamine, cannabis, we have nothing for those drugs, and there's addictive liability on each one of them. And so working on all these different elements is something that's really critical. And we need the community because I'm only as good to the community as I understand what the community needs. And that's something that we both have to work on both sides. But I do think, and I do hope that when we do speak to people who are not scientists, that we convey the commitment that we truly have to trying to solve this problem and help as many people as we can, and to kind of discard that idea that, we're kind of the mad scientists with hair coming out of our skulls and that, we're just waiting to use them as human guinea pigs. It's not at all the case. We need them to help to work with us, but it's really for ultimately to improve individual and public health.
Well, I'm sure you've never met one person who had an addiction problem who was happy they had it, that wanted to continue with it and think life is going great. They obviously know that this is an issue that's tearing their health, tearing their life apart from health to wealth to family to work. And obviously, nobody wants to live a life of chaos like which that can lead to.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. But I do think that there are, unfortunately, a significant number of people in that situation who don't feel like there's anything out there to help them. So they become kind of desperate, like this is my life, and there's no chance that I'm going to have any other life. And that's another thing that we really have to work toward to say, no, actually, there is, but it requires support. It re requires commitment on both sides, and that's tough. And not everybody feels like they have access. And I think accessibility is something that we could work on a lot more.
Well, we talk and you hear often talk about health equity. And I don't think we all really, if we're not in the medical field, understand what that is, health equity.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's not as simple as it seems, right? We can say, of course, this would be for everyone, regardless of race, religion, geographical location, economic status, would have access to appropriate health care. Sadly, that's just not the case in the United States. Not everybody has health insurance. Not everybody can get through the bureaucracy to determine whether they're eligible for Medicaid or Medicare. There's a lot of things that should be improved. But I would say the other thing that we don't have equity in is education. If people had were if we were able to better educate people about what's available and help them navigate that, I think that that would be a big step in the right direction. But the reality is that particularly in our communities where socioeconomics are really challenging, or geographical parts of the United States, for example, that simply are not close to a university or healthcare system or hospitals, and so they do what they can, but it's inadequate.
Well, I think that's why we're so lucky to have all of you that work at the National Institute of Health and to be really doing the hard work with the shovel out in the out in the field, literally trying to work with to get some sort of answers and some sort of help for these folks. And when we talk about the clinical studies that you do, it's important that it's being done. And I'd like you to talk about for folks who hear clinical studies, and I don't think really fully grasp what they are.
Mean, a clinical study can be many things. One that I can describe, which would make sense to this for this audience, is that when we're trying to determine or develop better medications, I can't just make a molecule in a laboratory and hand it out to someone who has a substance use disorder. There's many steps along the way, but the very important step is to test it in humans. First of all, to determine if it's safe. We do a lot of animal studies to determine safety, but we have to determine if it's safe in humans, and humans are not the same as the animals that we study in the laboratory. So that's the first thing. But then, most importantly, and typically those go well, the next thing is this medication going to be effective? Is it better than what's out there? And that's where a lot of medications fail, but we can't know that until we test it in our patient population. And speaking about your brother and people who have comorbidities with other disorders, that's a tough population. And a lot of times they're left out of those early stage studies because they don't necessarily work for everyone. And so, again, being inclusive and trying to target a person, patient population that it's most likely going to be effective in, but then broadening that. And at the end of the day, we need people to work with us to actually participate in those studies. And that's a challenge for us, but it's a critical one. And I wanted to advocate that in participating, you're part of it. You're part of the answer. So we're trying to come up with an answer to help our communities, but we can't do it without the communities participating.
Well, let's talk about the type of folks you were looking for. Give me a couple examples. If you the perfect test subjects, they would be what?
Right. So initially, healthy volunteers who have no substance use disorder. We need to test it first in them to be sure it's safe. Secondly, people who have, let's say, an opioid use disorder, someone who is addicted to heroin or now in Baltimore, essentially fentanyl, are willing and able, recognize that they have a problem that they can't solve on their own and are willing to participate in our studies. What we provide to them is full medical workup and very careful, thoughtful administration of these drugs, but also, especially with opioid use disorder, we do have medications. We have methadone, we have buprenorphine. These people who participate in our studies may end up getting into a treatment program while they're also working with us toward developing new medications. So that would be one group. There are others, but I think that the other thing that we have to recognize is that people who have an opioid use disorder may also smoke cigarettes, drink alcohol, smoke cannabis. I mean, those are things that then those are the people that we ultimately want to help because that's probably the most of the participants out there. Most of the people out there don't have a single substance use disorder, and that makes it complicated, but this is the situation that we have to address.
Is there an age group, or is there a does it matter if they're what size they are, what race, sex?
Yeah, that's a great question. So typically we don't test anybody under 18. They need to be a consenting adult. It can range. Sometimes the studies will say, under 6 or 18 to 65, for example. That's kind of random, but as you can imagine, someone who's older than 65 or an older person might have other medical complications which make it more difficult to do the studies in a safe manner. So we really th there's a lot of different criteria, and a lot of times those criteria do exclude people from studies. And so that's the other side of things. We want people to participate in our studies. Not everybody gets in because they may have some disorder or something that makes that an unhealthy for them to participate. But we do want both all genders, we do want all races, we want to reflect the full community. So we're not just producing a drug that's going to help one group.
Okay, more with Dr. Newman, PhD, with Advancing the Science of Addiction, coming up.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Advancing the Science of Addiction is back. My name is Jimmy Alexander, and we're here with Dr. Amy Newman, and she is the Scientific Director at NIDA IRP. And let's cover again, what is NIDA and what is your role and what do you do, Doctor?
Thank you, Jimmy. So NIDA is an acronym, of course, for the government. So we use a lot of acronyms. NIDA stands for the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We're one of the 27 institutes of the National Institutes of Health. The Intramural Research Program is a division of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and that is a research institution. So everyone in our division is a research scientist, and I am the scientific director, which means that I am responsible for leading the research of our intramural program. But importantly, I'm not doing all the work. I have 25 really excellent scientists who run their own research programs. What my
Hold on, but
job
you don't want to tell, you don't want the other scientists to hear you say that you're not doing any work, you know. Hold on.
I'm not doing
Before you
their
say
work. I'm
that,
not
before
doing
you
their
say
work.
that, you are doing a lot of work. There's a lot of meetings.
It's true. Okay. I'm not doing their work. What
Okay.
my job is to help guide, but also provide the resources, the infrastructure, the support so that they can do the best work that they can do. The other thing that I would like to mention is that there are, as I mentioned, 27 other institutes. Each one of those institutes has an intramural research program with a scientific director. And so another part of my job is to work with those other scientific directors at the NIH level so that we are leading the intramural research programs of the National Institutes of Health and developing the strongest programs that we can, and also to recognize overlap or collaborative opportunities. For example, with NIDA, we work very closely with the National Institute on Mental Health, which is focused on neuropsychiatric disorders, or the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, NIAAA. That institute is focused entirely on alcoholism, as the name implies, but there's a lot of overlap between what we're doing and what they're doing. And so, as a scientific director, it's important for me to be aware of the work that's being done in institutes that would be relevant to what we do and to generate collaborations. We often generate cross collaborations that lead to shared resources and so forth, again, to do the best science that we can do.
Now, you've been there for how long, Doctor?
Should I tell you that, Jimmy?
Well,
I have been at NIDA.
there's a reason I'm asking.
Now, I've been at NIDA since 1991. So I came
So
in.
you were a child scientist, obviously.
Yes, straight out of kindergarten. So they knew I had promise. I had actually been at the NIH to do what's called a postdoctoral fellowship, but in another institute. So what's typical for biomedical researchers is that we receive our PhDs in our academic institution, and then we typically want to hone in to really develop an expertise that will allow us to ultimately lead our own research program. So I did my postdoctoral fellowship at another institute at the NIH, the NIDDK, Di Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Diseases. And then I left to start my own research program, and then was recruited to NIDA in 1991, and slowly went up the tenure track and became a tenured scientist in the late 90s. And always, to be honest, the reason I always was interested in a leadership opportunity, and so I kind of focused on trying to get to that place, and I finally was able to do that in 2020 as a scientific director of NIDA.
Now, think about that first day you walked into NIDA back in 1991. What would you tell yourself then, right now? What advice would you give yourself then about the kind of work that is done there? Because I'm sure there were things going in that you had no idea about.
So the first thing I would tell myself is, you've got this. You can do this, because it was pretty overwhelming when I joined NIDA. It was largely a clinical research institution. The basic research, which is what I do, was kind of in its infancy, and that's why they hired me to start medicinal chemistry. Medicinal chemistry did not exist before I came, and the laboratories weren't set up for what I do. We need chemical fume hoods. We need instrumentation that didn't exist. And I was up in the attic, literally in the attic of our research building, looking for anything that I might be able to use in my lab, because I was on my own trying to figure out how was I going to build this lab and this program. But fortunately, I had good support, and I was able to start small, but we were able to grow to do the work that we do now. And over time, and that's been certainly 30 years, the institute has really gravitated toward basic and preclinical research. And now, since being scientific director, I've actually tried to bring that back, the balance back, because we really became a very basic research institute with just a small amount of clinical research. And so now we've built up our clinical research program, and I think the balance is better, but it's very different than what it was when I first started.
Well, I'm sure that when you meet these folks coming in for clinical trials, that it is, if they're having issues, that it's a godsend for them because they are looking for an answer. They're trying to make sure that, you know, that in something that could save their lives. And I'm not being hyperbolic when I say that. I mean, they have probably gone through hell and back and to come there, that they must look at all of you and just be so thankful. But I'm sure on the flip side, that you're meeting these people and you're learning more about addiction, not only scientifically, but anecdotally through their experiences. And it's something that hits every race, color, creed, age group.
I think that is correct, but I'm going to say that because I'm a basic scientist, I have to defer to my clinical researchers who actually are interacting with those patients every day, those participants every day. But the stories that I hear really vary. And I think that those who do come really do want to be part of the solution, and not only their own solution, but the bigger picture. But there are things that get in the way, you know, transportation, how childcare, all these real life challenges that make it difficult sometimes for them to participate in these studies. And as I mentioned before, they may have other health problems that cause them to not be able to participate in the studies. But I think that our clinical researchers are extremely good about directing them toward support, directing them toward treatment centers and so forth, because that's one thing that we are not a treatment center. We are a research institution. So if someone is seeking treatment, then the best thing we can do is educate them and guide them and direct them to get the treatment that they need.
Well, and that it further goes that these folks know that not only are they're helping others, yeah, because this science, they know what hell they're going through, that they're going to try, that this will hopefully help other people not have to deal and fight to keep living and like struggling to stay sober because of the work that's being done with them and the scientists there. I've noticed, you know, if you told me 25 years ago that it would be okay to smoke weed anywhere you want, but not cigarettes, I'd be, oh, that's crazy. Now you're looked at like, what's wrong with you? You're smoking cigarettes. Are you crazy? And you can smoke weed and it's like, oh, it's just weed. Are you surprised how socially, accepted marijuana smoking is everywhere, everywhere, it seems.
I mean, given my demographic, I am a little surprised. When I was a kid, people smoked cigarettes in the grocery store. And
We saw TV shows where they were smoking in the hospital. Remember back
exactly.
In the 70s.
The surgeon's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth while he's like operating. Yeah, exactly. Now, I haven't seen anybody smoke a joint in Safeway, but you know.
I have. No, not Safeway, but I've seen it. It's pretty normal everywhere. And no one gives them a dirty look, but cigarettes, like, hey, what's wrong with you? But with that, do you think that that's, I don't know the word healthy, but have we seen an upswing in cannabis abuse since this?
That's a really good question, Jimmy. And I think that I can't say about I don't know if there's an upswing in the misuse of cannabis, but there doesn't seem to be in the states, for example, like Colorado, who kind of started out being the state that allowed recreational cannabis use. There does not seem to be a big upswing in the addiction to cannabis. It's still there. And if people think that they can't become addicted to cannabis, they're incorrect. There is very clear addiction to cannabis, but it doesn't seem like that's increasing And what's going on with that? I can't really address it. I don't think that it's not my area of expertise, but I think that right now it depends. And the pendulum swings, right? So next year that may not be true, or there may be states in which it's more accessible than alcohol, for example. I think that I was in California recently. My oldest daughter and her husband live in California, and we were talking to someone who is a wine distributor, and he said, right now, wine is down because cannabis is up. People are smoking are more likely eating gummies or brownies or whatever, and they're going to bars in which there's no alcohol. It's non-alcoholic wine is not something I would recommend, but nevertheless,
That's called Welch's grape juice, I thought.
It tastes pretty terrible. But anyway, I mean, I do think the pendulum has swung in that direction, at least in some areas. This was in Los Angeles, but it'll swing back.
Well, it's interesting you said that cannabis is addictive because a lot of people would say, "Hey, it's not like it's addictive like any other drug." And to hear you say that it is, I think, probably surprising for some folks.
Yeah, I think that that's the misnomer. I think that people really believe that. And, the question is it as addictive as cigarettes or cocaine? And I think the jury is generally would say maybe not, but that doesn't mean that it's not addictive. There's very clear addiction, there's very clear withdrawal. If someone has a cannabis use disorder and decides that they need to stop, it's really tough, and it really affects them for a long period of time. One thing that people might be find surprising is that it really affects sleep in a very negative way. People who have cannabis use disorder, like, wait a minute, why is that right? But it's very much affects their sleep, and months and even a year later, they can have significant sleep problems. They can't sleep, and that the that kicks them back into using cannabis because they're like, well, at least I could sleep.
Yeah, wow. Very interesting. Thank you so much. We have more with Dr. Amy Newman. She is the scientific director at NIDA IRP. That's coming up on Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Advancing the Science of Addiction is back. I'm Jimmy Alexander, along with Amy Newman. She is PhD, and she serves as the scientific director at NIDA, IRP, and of course, that's part of the National Institutes of Health. And Doctor, we're talking about the research that you all are doing on drug abuse and the research, the clinics that you're doing. And so, if somebody decides that they want to be a part of one of these research programs, they would come in, and what would happen as they're there?
Right. Well, first of all, they have to find out about it, right? So there's lots of different ways to do that. We have a website that if you just type in NIDA IRP, you'll come to it. But it is a website that really shows the big picture, our entire institute, all of our investigators, all the laboratories. But there's a tab that is about participating in research, and there's all the information there to how to access us and how to come in. And then so people will come in, and they'll call, or they'll be called, and they will provide a lot of information that we can then use to see which studies might they fit into. If it's a healthy volunteer, for example, as I mentioned, those are critical for our studies. They say, look, I don't have a substance use disorder, but I would really like to participate in research to help those who do. And once the medical history is taken, then we can decide which studies they would best fit into them. And ultimately, they come to our clinic, and they get the questionnaires done, and the basic, I don't know, all the temperature and blood pressure and maybe an EKG and so forth. And then we put them into the studies, and it goes from there. And again, I know that you'll be interviewing other clinical researchers next, Jimmy, and they will probably be able to tell you a lot more details of what happens after that.
Well, it's interesting. And again, I'm going to give all of you a compliment. I've talked to so many of the researchers there. And what's really heartwarming is you can tell that this is a labor of love. This is something that they are doing from the bottom of their hearts. You know, they are trying to do what they can to make sure that folks are able to find out as much as they can about drug addiction and addiction as a whole. And it's pretty amazing the stories that we've heard here and the reasons why they have gotten into this line of work. It's been pretty moving and touching. Now, with that, with the current landscape of addiction crisis, what do you think the community should understand about addiction itself?
Yeah, I would say it can happen to anyone. No one is immune to this. There are certainly some people who may be more likely to become addicted, and this can be both genetic and environmental. If you're in an environment where everyone is taking heroin or whatever, smoking cannabis, then you're more likely to be influenced by that. But if you have a family history of substance use disorder or alcoholism, you may be more genetically inclined to develop an addiction. So that's the one thing that no one is immune to it. And that, however, if you are in this circumstance, we are here to help. We don't have all the answers, but we are here to help. And something that you mentioned, and I can speak to because I'm a basic research scientist. And so there is that big picture of, gosh, what I'm doing could ultimately help someone out there who's really suffering. But one of the things I think is important on a science standpoint, especially for your listeners who may be interested, younger people who want to think about going into science or addiction medicine and so forth, is that as a basic research scientist, it is this, the disorder is heartbreaking. The science is amazingly cool and so interesting and so fun to be a part of and to feel like you are really, like I said in the very beginning, you're doing something that no one else has ever done. You're discovering something that in the brain, how it works, how cocaine is producing that effect. Why are some substances more addictive than others? What part of the brain is involved with withdrawal, which is a very serious thing. And most people, the reason that they relapse is because of withdrawal, because it's such a miserable physical and psychological situation that they simply can't face it, and they need to get more drug to start that whole addiction cycle over. So we are excited because it's at every level. It is just a thrill to be a part of that big picture, but ultimately to think that we might actually not only help those individuals, but help the families. You said it yourself, you lost a brother. I mean, that was a devastating thing for your family, for your community. And so if we can help individuals, we're going to help a lot more people. And there's nothing like that, Jimmy. It's just something that you really can't help but love.
I can't imagine. You mentioned what happened with our family, and I've spoken to a lot of folks who have gone through similar situations, and it's all the guilt. It's the guilt. We should have, could have, would have, and you can't live like that, because there's nothing more that we could have done. And I've heard from so many people who have, like in Al-Anon, where they talk about that, let's say somebody kicks whatever habit, they're on the wagon, sober, that let's say they, and I'll use beer for example, let's say they drank a six pack of beer every day, that it can be a month, it can be 2 years, it can be 5 years, that they don't come back and start drinking just one beer, that a lot of times they go back to exactly what they were doing in the amount, that six pack of beer, whatever amount of time later, and your body isn't accustomed to that anymore because you had built up this tolerance, I guess. And that's where you hear a lot of people who will overdose, and it's like, well, they have been sober for whatever amount of time. It's because they've gone back to exactly what they stopped doing. Have you heard that before, Doctor?
This is really the genesis of why we're having so many overdoses, because people perhaps have stopped taking their opioid and they have then lost that tolerance. And then if they go back and take the same amount that they took before, one of the significant side effects of opioids is respiratory depression. And what can happen then is that they've taken too much for their body to absorb. They then go into respiratory depression and they die. The other thing is that in Baltimore and many cities across the country is that there's not heroin on the streets anymore. It's mostly fentanyl. Fentanyl is far more potent. It takes far less fentanyl to get the same high or the same effects that heroin produced. So someone who was addicted to heroin now gets fentanyl. They overdose right away because it's way too much, and they go into respiratory depression and they pass away. And it's a very serious problem, and it happens a lot.
And it knows no bounds of age, race, you know, no matter how much money you make a year.
No, absolutely not. I mean, another area is the criminal justice system. So someone is imprisoned and they may not have access to their opioid, and they get out and they go out and take the same amount that they took before they went to prison. It's a death sentence for that exact reason.
And, you know, bringing up Elvis the first time during one of these shows, and, you know, the irony of Elvis going to the White House and saying that he wanted to be a drug enforcement person to get a badge for it, even though he was on all these prescription medications that eventually took his life. But he was looking at it like, well, that's not real drugs, that's medicine compared to street drugs. But we found out over the last 30 years that that's taking a lot of lives.
It was certainly the beginning of the national opioid crisis was the whole OxyContin story, which was, of course, this is a non-addictive opioid analgesic. It was marketed to all the physicians and dentists out there. Don't worry, you can put your patient on this for a long time and they won't become addicted. And the reality is that that wasn't correct, and that people started to take more and more in order to get that pain relief. But actually, they had become addicted to it. It's an opioid. It's a prescription drug. And that's the sad thing, because originally, those patients went to their physician to get help. And their physicians were doing what they thought were right. But it turned out to not be the right thing. It developed this whole generation of people who are addicted to opioids. And then suddenly the physician said, oh my gosh, this is a problem. I can't prescribe you any more opioids. So then what did they do? They went to the street and they got heroin, eventually fentanyl, because then they could access that. And that has been the opioid crisis that we are still deeply in.
And it's just so damn sad, because these folks went in for trying to find some sort of relief from whatever agony that they were in, from neck to back to whatever issues. They thought they would find solace in this non-addictive medication, but really it sent them down the path to destruction and in a lot of cases, death.
It's so true. I don't know if you saw the series Dope Sick, but if you haven't seen it, I would highly recommend it. It exactly tells this story of a small town physician, and he ultimately develops his own opioid use disorder, and it's a killer, but it's, I think, the reality of that area and throughout the country.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Newman. We're going to have more with Dr. Newman coming up on Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
We have more here with Dr. Amy Newman from, she's Scientific Director at NIDA, IRP, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. I'm Jimmy Alexander here with Advancing the Science of Addiction. And we're talking about these clinical studies. And obviously, you're looking for folks who are battling addiction, but also folks who aren't battling addiction.
Exactly. I mean, we want both, because we need healthy volunteers. There are a lot of studies that we do just to understand the healthy brain, and to be able to compare it and to compare it to people who have an addiction. And so we are looking for all sorts of individuals who are willing to help us, because we can't do this alone. We have the ideas, we have the technologies, we have the research and the evidence-based practice, but that evidence-based practice is going to evolve as we understand more about the disorders that we're dealing with.
Now, of course, people would want to do this to help humankind, but also something happens where you're helping their wallets. I mean, this is something that they would be compensated for their time, right?
Absolutely true. Yes, exactly. There, and depending on the study, there's money, there's gift cards, there's all kinds of compensation. We don't expect people to do this for free. That is the incentive there to try to mitigate the time that they spend, because actually, when you are part of a participant study, you're a participant in these studies, it is time that you're taking away from something else. And so we compensate you for that time.
And do you know how long off the top of your head, how often they would have to come in?
It completely depends on the
It
study.
differs
It could
on.
be one day. It could be that you don't come in, that you're participating in a phone or text message or some other social media type work, that's the work of Dr. Brenda Curtis in our institution. So it really depends on the study, and or it can be long term. If you're in a clinical study, you might even spend the night or spend a week or a period of time so that we can monitor you very carefully and be sure that you are not only safe, but that your situation is improving.
When you started in 1991 at the tender age of 12, which was pretty amazing that they let you do that. But when you started there, did you ever dream that this would grow into the size it is now?
Oh yeah, no, that's again a great question. In 1991, the big drug of interest was cocaine. It was kind of an upswing, and actually across socioeconomic classes, but actually in the upper class, cocaine was kind of the thing to do. And we still, to date, and that's kind of a sad state of affairs, but we still don't have medications to treat cocaine use disorder or the psychostimulants. They're called cocaine and methamphetamine, still very serious. So we focused our work entirely on cocaine. We weren't even looking at opioids. We at that time were thinking, well, there's already buprenorphine and methadone for people who have opioid use disorder. The overdose situation was nothing compared to what it is now. And so that wasn't really on our radar as much as the drugs for which we have no treatment. And then over time, we started to see this very serious statistic that continued to grow. And we thought, gosh, at least in my laboratory, we continue to do research on cocaine and methamphetamine. But it was clear that we needed to divert some of our attention to the opioid crisis and try to see if we could help with developing medications. And in our case, medications that are non-opioids. So right now, methadone and buprenorphine, those are opioids in and of themselves. We thought maybe we can come up with a medication that doesn't work like an opioid, does not have addictive liability itself, but might be able to be helpful by itself or in conjunction with the medications that we have out there to improve their efficacy, their effectiveness, or to maybe reduce the dose at which someone needs to take in order to not crave the drug that they have a use disorder of, for example, opioids.
Now, when you mentioned like the difference in cocaine and opioids, it must have been so strange when opioids became the killer that it became, because you're going from what was street drugs to pharmaceuticals that are prescribed to you by your doctor. That was such a night and day compared to cocaine with what you started in 1991.
Completely agree. And I think that was, we were a little slow to catch on to that, right? Because we didn't realize what is going on here. I mean, I don't think anyone really did. I certainly didn't. It took longer than it probably should have to kind of realize the situation at hand. And, Jimmy, as you well know, there's lots of media out there, and there's especially now there's lots of social media, and so what to believe, and certainly the physicians initially didn't think that this was there on their watch, and the drug companies were certainly not, Purdue Pharmaceutical is not going to take responsibility. So it took a long time, a lot of investigation, and sadly a lot of lives to figure out, wow, this is happening because of this. And then I think this next wave now, I think the prescription opioid problem is still out there, but the bigger problem is fentanyl. The bigger problem is fentanyl. That has become what's on the streets. It's cheap, it doesn't take much, It's much easier to get into this country, and it's synthetic, which means that people can make it in home laboratories or in big laboratories outside of our borders. It doesn't require poppies to grow, which is where all the other opioids originally come from. And so it's the biggest threat. And it's one that we haven't got a really great handle on yet.
Well, it's just heartbreaking, because it's so sad, doctor, that think there were scientists who created the fentanyl, instead of trying to do what they can to help people, they're trying to get rich by taking advantage of people's weaknesses and addictions. Pretty awful.
It's, there's nefarious people everywhere. Sad to say, it is part of our human being, unfortunately. And it is a place, especially in places where a lot of the fentanyl is coming from, they don't have a way to make as much money legitimately. And that, and there's a whole social situation with cartels and all that kind of thing. It is really sad, but it is. And then something like fentanyl, you need one person to know what they're doing, and then they can teach everybody else. It's just like your lasagna, Jimmy. You don't have to be a chef. You don't have to be a Michelin star chef to make lasagna.
Well, I tell you, sometimes my husband says it causes him issues too. I mean, it's not as healthy as it should be. Too much garlic. But with this, Doc, let's go over one more time. If somebody would like to be in one of the trials, please tell us how they would go about doing that.
Yeah, I think that the easiest thing is to hopefully have an access to a computer and internet and just type in NIDA IRP. You will come up with our website. It's irp.nida.nih.gov, but that's kind of a lot to remember. But just type in NIDA IRP. You'll come right up to our website, and right at the top, it says participation in studies, and you click on that. And that is the easiest way. Hopefully through our community efforts, we are giving people more information. We're doing a lot of work in our local communities to advertise that we're here. We're here to help. We want people to participate. But that's the easiest. That's the easiest place, is to just go to our website, and it's all right there.
And I want to ask you to do this for somebody who may be listening, whose family member, loved one, friend has an addiction. What advice would you give this person to be supportive to that loved one?
Yeah, my biggest advice is love them despite this, because at the end of the day, that's what they need the most. They need to know that you're supportive, and that you will do everything that you can to get them help, and get them help as quickly and as avidly as possible. And don't give up, because the definition of addiction is the chronically relapsing disorder. People will relapse. And you have to recognize that and not say, that's it, I gave you a chance, and walk away. You have to be willing to stick it with them forever, for their whole life, and to let them know that you love them and you support them and you're going to do everything you can to help them. I think that the cases that I'm familiar with, that are closest to me, are the cases that are successful, are because the family support was so great. Having said that, it's not a panacea. People will ultimately, we can't control another person's behavior, and either on purpose or more likely not on purpose, they may overdose. And then as a family member, you have to believe, like you've said, Jimmy, you have to believe it every single day that you did everything that you could.
Well, we appreciate all the hard work that you guys are doing, even though you said that you're just doing meetings, which I don't believe. But anyway, well, thank you for tuning in to Advancing the Science of Addiction. And join us next time for another insightful episode. Until then, stay informed and take care.